Yes, well, welcome everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker to you, Sabine Storrand, who is a professor full professor for algorithmics in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Konstanz since 2018. So not for such a long time yet. She has studied biomathematics in Greifswald, actually, and she told me that her life only got out of control once she actually did her PhD in computer science, which she did in Stuttgart. Maybe she can tell us more about that, how she lost control over her life. And after her positions in Stuttgart, she has been in Freiburg as a postdoc and then as a junior professor in Würzburg. She has received many awards for outstanding papers or mentions for outstanding papers, for instance, at AAAI or at ICAPS. So lots of interesting research going on in her group. She primarily studies applied graph algorithms and applies them to interesting topics such as electromobility. And what I also recognized in your publications is that you actually studied simple algorithms in the sense of simple heuristics to solve complex problems. I'd be happy to talk more about that at some other point. But today she's going to talk about graph algorithms for movement data processing. I'm very much looking forward to your talk, Sabine.
Yes, thank you so much for the introduction. Can everybody see the slides? Okay, great. So to stay on topic, to show you very quickly what Wolfgang just told you about me, this here is my personal movement data for the last 34 years, slightly simplified, which ends here at the University of Konstanz, where, as you said, I'm the head of the algorithmics group. Let me very quickly tell you what we do on a daily basis. So the research field you're concerned with is called algorithm engineering. And what we like to have given is a well-defined application problem, as our research is mainly methodology-driven. These problems can come from basically anywhere. And if nobody hands us a problem, we also not shy to make up our own problems and then call that fundamental research. And the goal is always to come up with algorithms that solve the problem at hand optimally and efficiently. So we want to have good solutions in a short amount of time, which of course is not always easily possible. But what's very important for us is that the algorithms we develop work well both in theory and practice. So what you see here on the slide is a simplified version of the so-called algorithm engineering cycle. So typically when we start to study a problem, we first conduct a theoretical analysis, which usually is looking for problems which are kind of related and then learning the complexity of the problem and then come up with some baseline solutions. And then we implement those and try to test them on a large variety of benchmark instances, preferably real data. And then these observations we get, so on certain instances it works well, on others it does not, we try to feed back into the theoretical analysis to try to explain those observations also on a sound theoretical basis. And then this might go round and round in this cycle until we hopefully converge to something which again works very well in practice, but also comes with theoretical performance guarantees. And we can apply this methodology to a wide range of applications. So here's some selections of typical applications we are dealing with. And today we will focus, of course, on movement data and algorithms that help to process and mine this kind of data. So when I talk about movement data, I usually mean trajectories. So trajectories, for example, obtained by GPS measurements are merely sequences of measurements. So here in this depiction, there are two spatial dimensions and one time dimension. Of course, we could also have more spatial dimensions, or if you're a physicist, also more time dimensions, but we'll stick to the simple version here throughout the talk. And one very important distinction we make in our work is between restricted and unrestricted trajectories. The restricted means that a movement is bound to an underlying network. So for example, if you drive by car, it would be nice of you to stick to the streets, and same if you're a train conductor, you should not leave the train tracks. So these are examples of restricted trajectories. And on the other hand, we have the unrestricted movement. That of course doesn't mean that the movement does not have to obey any limitations. So for example, if you have a vessel track, then this cannot go over land, but it still would be classified as unrestricted movement because it does not have to stick to a certain type of network. So here you see two examples on the slide. The upper one, this nice pattern, is made by a crop dusting plane. And below you can see a flock of seagulls doing their thing. So that would be unrestricted movement examples. And of course, as the world is not black and white, there's also a category in the middle here, which we call semi-restricted. And yeah, typical examples are pedestrians or cyclists, which stick to paths or lanes most of the time. But when we cross, for example, marketplaces or parks or meadows or large parking lots, this resembles more unrestricted movement. And so we have to take care of these different kinds of possibilities in our processing pipeline. And usually the very first step of movement data processing when we deal with restricted trajectories is the so-called map matching step. So here we are given this underlying network, so for example, the road network of a certain country, and we are given our sequence of measurements. And what we'd like to do is to identify the path in the graph which was most likely the one which led to that particular sequence of measurements. And this is very important, for example, for self-localization or for traffic analysis, and also, as we will later briefly discuss, for indexing trajectories in a nice and accessible fashion. But there are certain challenges related to that problem, and that mainly is due to uncertainty. So on the one hand, we have uncertainty in measurements, of course. So if you make GPS measurements, it might be that your localization is not very precise, but that you have actually some radius in which your location probably is, but you don't know the exact one. And also depending on the sampling density, it might be that you have to interpolate between measurements. So there are, of course, tons of approaches to do that depending on the kind of data you have and kind of map context you can deal with. But one very general approach is called a layered graph approach. So here's a little sketch. So it's a very simple idea. So for each of these measurements, what we do is we collect all of the candidates, so all the nodes of the network, which might be the ones which were visited by that particular trajectory. And we do that for all of the measurements. And now we come up with some interpolation model. So a typical one for cars is that the movement happens on shortest paths between the measurements. And so what we do now is to compute all shortest paths from each candidate in one layer to each candidate in the next. And you might already figure it, this might take a long time and might lead to a huge layered graph. But if you're able to come up with this full representation of the possibilities, then you can compute pretty easily here the least cost path in this layered graph, which then gives you the least cost path in the original graph, which then hopefully is the one which really was traversed by the moving object. And yeah, as I already said, the bottleneck here is that you might have huge amounts of candidates, especially if you have a large error radius. And so here, this is just a symbolic depiction. If I would have really put here all of the nodes from this radius here, then yeah, the slide would be 5 kilometers in width probably. So what we came up with is a technique to pre-process the whole network such that if you know what interpolation model you will use, you can actually prune the search space here radically. And with that, you can achieve running times which are in the order of a few milliseconds. So even if you have a network with millions of nodes and edges and you have sparse GPS measurements with large error radii, you get a good path candidate very quickly. And so this basic problem can be solved rather efficiently. And that's why we turned, of course, to more complicated problems. And the first thing which we are interested here is to consider non-GPS trajectories. Or to be more precise, trajectories where we do not have any absolute location measurements. So why should we consider this? Well, one problem with GPS and also related localization schemes as GSM or Wi-Fi is that they might not be available precisely everywhere. So for example, for GPS, if you have tall buildings, this might distort or deflect the signal. And also there's some privacy concerns. So you can use GPS in a completely passive manner, but especially at the beginning, when you start to use GPS with your smartphone, for example, usually you give data to a third party in order to get this localization quicker. And so it would be really nice if you could just self-localize and do map matching very locally without revealing your information to anyone. And the scheme we came up with here is called Path Shapes. So if you have a modern car, it should have an onboard computer. And what this does automatically is to record all of your turning actions, so whenever you make a turn, and also all of the distances you have driven at a certain speed. And what that gives us is like a relative representation of that trajectory. So for example, here, this does not have any absolute orientation, but it just says, okay, the car drove 10 meters straight, then it was a right turn of 70 degrees, then another 200 meters straight, and so on and so on. And now on the left side, you see a cutout of a network, and we try to find this particular shape in the network. And although you might say, well, road networks look all of the same everywhere, you can see here that we only have one full mesh, actually. I don't know how well you can see it, but it's here in pink. And we have a lot of partial meshes, but they are all pretty short. So for example, here you see with two turns, I don't know if you can see my mouse, I hope so. Otherwise you have to look very closely. But we already for, yeah, let's say the first quarter of the path, we only have a unique mesh. But this, of course, is just one small example. So we also did a large scale study to confirm this or to check this hypothesis on general networks. And of course, we also had to take into consideration here that also these measurements come with certain uncertainties because also the recording of the angles is not always fully precise. And there are lots of other things to consider. Like if you circumvent a pothole or something like that, it should not completely distort the shape of your trajectory. And so what you can see here on the x-axis are just different models which can deal with uncertainty. And what you see on the y-axis is how long the paths need to be on average such that we can find a unique match in the graph. And so the red line here encodes the data for the whole road network of Germany with roughly 20 million nodes and 40 million edges. And we can see here that even with pretty relaxed models, we can get for a path which has a length of roughly 10 kilometers, we usually have a unique match in the graph. And we also considered Manhattan here as one of the worst case instances because it has this grid-like structure basically everywhere, and you would suspect that all of the path shapes look pretty much the same, but actually because, in particular because of their one-way streets and very restricted turning opportunities, you can actually also find unique paths in the Manhattan network quite quickly. And so this was kind of a sanity check, but now the new problem, of course, was how to find such a match efficiently in a large network. So before we said the bottleneck is that if you have like a huge disk, so a large error radius around the GPS measurement, then yeah, we have lots of candidates. But here it's even worse because in the beginning we could be everywhere, right? So at any location in the network, so we have way more candidates to start from. And so the question was how to do that efficiently. And what we came up with here is a reduction to a text search problem. So finding a small pattern in a huge amount of data is something which, for example, Google does any moment. So when you type in some query words and you get the documents which contain that query word within a fraction of a second. And this inspired us to think about how could we use the same methodology here. And so what we do here is we basically convert this path shape into a word. And then we do something similar with the whole road network. So we have a text describing the shapes in the road network. Of course, you have to be very careful here such that it doesn't blow up. So we cannot, of course, have all of the possible paths in the network described by that. But it suffices to have the paths which have a unique structure. And with the right kind of pre-processing, we can pre-compute a data structure, which then allows us to do pattern search for this kind of path shape in the fraction of seconds as well. So we have real-time search or self-localization with that scheme. And once we have a path which has a sufficient length, so over this bound you see here in this plot, and you also have GPS-like precision. Okay, so that was about map matching trajectories which are restricted. But now what about the other two types we talked about in the introduction, namely about semi-restricted and unrestricted trajectories? So here we do not have an underlying graph. And so the map matching problem now just asks for any path which was the one most likely traversed by the trajectory. And now you might say, well, why should we do their map matching at all? Can we just keep the raw data? But that has two disadvantages. So actually there could be observations or measurements which make no sense. So for example, if you have the vessel, there could be measurements and was close to the shore which are on land, but you actually know that this is impossible. So this is something you could incorporate. And on the other hand, if you have very dense sampling, then you have a huge amount of raw data and you might want to abstract that in a sensible fashion. And here again, it makes sense to take the map context into account. And so what do we do in the absence of a graph? Well, of course we make one up, but we call it free space tessellation to sound more scientific. So here you see two examples from Konstanz actually. So this is the Strandbad Horn. This is some church in Konstanz. And you see in blue the measurements which were collected. And in black, you see the underlying path network. In red, you see obstacles, so mainly buildings. And in green, you see free spaces, so where free movement is actually possible. And if you would just do a normal map matching approach here, so we would just match the blue crosses here to the black edges, then you would see that you would lose all semantic characteristics of this path here. So it actually probably say here, the person turned around on that street, then went back there and then down there, which would completely distort what really happened. And so what we did here is to triangulate these free spaces in such a manner that the shape and the distances of any kind of measurements which go across this area are well preserved. And yeah, with the right kind of map matching approach, you can actually differentiate pretty well between the path sections which really happened in a network and the ones which happened across free spaces. And if you have completely unrestricted trajectories, you might think it might be a good idea to do something similar, so to just triangulate the ambient space. But actually, it's not so easy to do that in the right kind of granularity. So here you can get the idea of how coarse or fine-grained it is based on the existing path network and based on the complexity of the obstacles. But if you have something like that here, which goes across all of Europe or even beyond, then it's not easy to decide on which level this abstraction should happen. And so there we use other techniques. So this is not our work now, but from another group which considers so-called group diagrams. So here you see some geese tracks and one common graph representation of all of them. And it's actually very closely related to the process of so-called map generation. So how we got these black edges in the first place, especially also by just collecting huge amount of trajectories and then kind of comprising them together, compacting them into this underlying network. And this is something we can also do for other kind of trajectory data. And so for each type of trajectory, we can actually do this map matching based on a carefully constructed graph. Okay, so in the following, we will now always assume that we have a graph and the trajectory. And now we will do some applications which go beyond this map matching approach. So we want to analyze or mine this trajectory data. And one question we are particularly interested here is why do people move and how are paths chosen? And sometimes that's pretty easy. So we can differentiate pretty well between whether someone went to work or went shopping or delivered post. But for some other trajectories, it might be very difficult for some automatic classification approach to see the purpose of that trajectory, as you can see here on the left. But what I want to get a little bit more in detail now is how are the paths chosen? So if you just want to go from A to B, there are of course many possibilities. And what studies have found is that people very rarely actually use the shortest path or the quickest path. And I might say, well, maybe they just don't know about the quicker option. But we talked, for example, a lot to people at Apple Maps. And they get these queries, right, from the users. They say, tell me the shortest path from A to B. And they tell them, and then they observe that they do. And very often, they still choose another route. And so maybe people are just stubborn. But what we were interested in is to see whether we can actually deduce individual preferences and see why people choose certain routes over others. And the model in which we operate looks as follows. So in conventional route planning, we just have a single edge cost, typically the travel time at a certain time of the day. But now we say each cost can have actually multiple edge costs. So for example, the travel time, but also the gas price, maybe the number of traffic lights, the curviness of the road, or any other type of road condition. So Apple Maps, for example, uses over 60 criteria here. And what we think is the underlying idea of the user is that there is a preference vector alpha, and alpha just has weights which tell how important this particular criterion at this particular position here is for the user. So here in this example, this alpha 0.5, 0.5, which is say, okay, both of these criteria here are of equal importance to me. And so the perceived cost of this edge for this one particular user would be just the average of these two. But for example, if the preference vector would be 1, 0, then he would just care for the very first thing. So in this scenario, just for the quickest path, and the perceived cost would be 20. But you can think about any kind of weighting vector here. And the assumption is that the user really wants to drive the path which minimizes the perceived costs. And now our research question is that given a set of paths driven by some particular user, can we deduce this preference vector? And this would allow for a better analysis, of course, of the trajectories, but also for better personalized route recommendations. So if we know what people are looking for in a route, we can then, of course, come up and they ask us in the next query how to get from A to B with a route which better suits their needs. All right, so how can we do that? It might scream that this is a machine learning problem, but actually this is pretty difficult to do with machine learning. So on the one hand, again, we would like to have the data in private so that nobody can see it, but it's also difficult to obtain training data, even if you would have access to all of these kind of paths in a compact manner, because you would need to figure out these alpha for the training in any case. And it's even if you ask someone about his route preferences, it might be very difficult to express that in form of such a vector, even if that is used for underlying decision making. So we want to have an approach which guarantees us that if there is some alpha which explains all routes, it really finds that. And we do that with the help of linear programs. So unfortunately, I cannot explain within a short amount of time how linear programs work and what they can do. So for the sake of this talk, just imagine that this is a magical language. And if you can express your problem in that magical language, it will be solved efficiently for you. So this sounds pretty convenient. And the language actually consists of constraints and equalities. And so how can we express our problem here? Our let's look for a good alpha in terms of inequalities and equalities. That is actually pretty easy because we know that for each path the user has chosen, this has to have been the best path among all possible alternative paths from the same source to the same target. And so what we demand here is actually that all these paths are more pricey, so they have a larger cost than our actual path that was chosen. Okay, and this for all of the paths the user has driven. So that sounds like we already solved the problem, right? We can express it in our magical language. Now we should get a solution quickly, but there is a catch. And the problem is that there might actually be exponentially many alternative paths. So think about you would drive from, let's say, Hamburg to Munich. Then of course, there might be only one or very few shortest paths. But if you would now consider all possible paths to drive from the one location to the other, there might be hundreds, thousands, or even millions of possibilities. And so the problem here is that while we have this magical language, which could help us to solve the problem, we will not even be done explaining our problem within that language within a certain amount of time. So we cannot enumerate all of these exponentially many alternative paths within a matter of even hours or days. And the solution to that is to just not do that. And it's called lazy constraint generation. And here's the algorithm in a nutshell. So we start without considering any of those constraints, but we just guess some alpha, which we think might be the one which explains all of the movement of a particular user. So we look at that guy and say, well, he looks like he just cares for speed. So we set our vector to 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, and then what we do is we check whether this value actually works by checking for each driven path, whether it's actually optimal for the selected alpha. And if it is, well, we are done, right? We found an alpha which explains the user preferences and we can just return that value. And otherwise what we get is a path which violates this assumption. So we actually find for this particular alpha star a path that is better. And that means that we need now to exclude this particular alpha from our further search. And we can exclude that by actually adding this constraint to our problem description. And then we have a problem which is now phrased in this particular language. And we can now solve this partial problem to get a new alpha star with which we can retry the whole process. So in actually checking whether our path is optimal or then getting a better alternative is something we can easily do in polynomial time. So this even works with a standard route planning algorithm, so with Dijkstra's algorithm. But if you invest a little bit of research into so-called personalized route planning, you can do that within a fraction of a second. So actually in a few milliseconds, you can do that check and also get revealed this new path in case it exists. And I might say, well, this sounds nice, but couldn't it happen anyway that in the end, we have to enumerate all of these alternative paths because in each round, we get a new one and then another one and then another one. And the answer to that, surprisingly, is no. So it's not only that it works very well in practice, but also in theory, we can actually prove that after a polynomial number of rounds, so a few number of rounds in the size of the network, you will find a feasible preference vector alpha, which explains all of the path choices. So an alpha which really is correct for all of the constraints, although we only have to check a handful. Okay, so this is where nice theory comes into play here. So we can give this guarantee. So we do not just observe that it works in practice, but we can also make sure that this is always the case, also on data we've never seen before. And yeah, we checked that actually. So we considered paths driven by the user and then made route recommendations for new queries. And we checked the difference between those paths and the paths driven. And we could certify that this makes sense, so that there are only very small deviations once we figured out good preference vector. Okay, so that was what I want to tell you about to check the analysis. Then another important topic in movement data processing is storing and indexing that data. And of course, this is then a problem if you have huge sets of trajectories, which is usually the case. So for example, the OpenStreetMap project also hosts public traces, so volunteer traces which people uploaded. And there are millions and millions of those. But there's actually no good search engine to access the data you're interested in. And one typical query that we would like to answer is to report all of the trajectories that intersect a certain space-time cube. So I say, okay, this is my view rectangle, and I want to know all of the trajectories which went through there Monday between 8 and 10, for example. And the previous schemes which dealt with this problem usually had a similar framework, and that was to compress all of the data so you can store it in the first place, but then to locally decompress the data within this query rectangle such that you can get access to the data in there and the surrounding areas and then do these checks. But the problem with this decompression is that it's actually very slow and also blows up the data, at least within this view rectangle which you're considering. And so we developed a new approach and a new data structure called CREEP, which takes care of this problem by not having to decompress the data in order to look for trajectories which traverse certain parts of the network or certain times of the space-time cube. So the main idea here is to combine three different kinds of data structures. So one is a contraction hierarchy, which actually is a prominent pre-processing-based route planning technique, for example, used by Google Maps in order to make route planning queries happening within a millisecond or even beyond that. Then the R stands for an R-tree, which is a data structure which partitions the ambient space into rectangles and allows for efficient search within those rectangles. And the EAP comes from a heap, and a heap data structure is something where you can plug in priorities. And so what we get here is a hierarchical search data structure, which allows us to get all of these trajectories, and we can report them within a microsecond per trajectory, which sounds fast, but actually is still too slow if you want to report huge sets of them. And so what this data structure also nicely allows us is to get a compressed view of these trajectories. So if you're, for example, just interested in coloring all edges or nodes traversed by trajectories in this answer set here, then this data structure can give it automatically to you in such a compact manner. And this leads us to the last topic, that is visualization. So this data structure here also helps you if you want to have a quick visualization of a huge trajectory data set. But there are other aspects we have considered. So for example, what kind of data you would need to have locally on your smartphone, again, to have some privacy concerns resolved in order to do route planning and data analysis just locally there without having to store huge networks or huge data structures locally. And also we are interested, for example, in graph and data simplification on different levels of granularity without having these distinct levels, or the zoom levels you usually have in map services, but where you can have a continuous simplification in order to cater better for example, different resolution devices. And one thing I want to quickly show you in a demo is how we do real-time visualization of public transit data, so of all of the buses and ferries and whatever moves around in the network at the moment around the world. So our data set consists of over 1 million stations, and there are millions of departures daily, and we also consider real-time data. And the way it works is, again, by a careful indexing, temporal and spatial indexing into a multi-level data structure. And let me quickly switch my screen share to the demo. So yeah, now here, so this is now here is New York, for example. Okay, it's 6 a.m. there, so it's not too much going on. But what you can see here is, for example, the subway moving in real time around the network. And yeah, we do that in different levels of granularity, as you can see here. And we can not only do that in New York, but we actually have data for a huge amount of cities and also for all of Germany. So I always like to go to Amsterdam to show real-time aspects, because usually something is delayed here. Let's see whether this is the case now, whether they let me down. Okay, this is +0. Very unfortunate. No delays at the moment. Oh, here, no. Also all 0. That's a pity. Okay, but I promise, oh, 17 seconds delay. What a shame. Okay, but usually we also have some minutes or even hours delay. So yeah, you can see here the complete track where the vehicle is right now, and also the thing which we think will happen in the future. So sometimes delays will be resolved, sometimes we aggregate. So, and of course we have smooth movement here, which is realized by interpolation. So, maybe to show you how well the system scales, we can also speed things up. So this doesn't change reality, just my view. So we can actually make this like 30 times as fast. And then yeah, you can have a projection in the future about where all of these vehicles are and what they're going to do. So here we have different kinds of importance. So if you zoom out, we will see only the long distance things moving. But if you zoom in, we also see local buses and other things like that. And yeah, if you want to play around with that, it's openly available at tracker.geoops.ch. All right, then let me switch back to the presentation. Tell you a little bit of ongoing projects. So we have a TFG project about dynamic and customizable exploitation of trajectory data at the moment. And one thing we are looking into is social routing. So what we can learn from people which know the area, which have moved around in a certain part of the city, or also with public transit vehicles. Because there again, it doesn't seem to be the case that shortest or quickest path, at least according to the data we have, is usually the one which is preferred. So it might make sense to at least bootstrap such route planning engines by the paths which were already taken in the past. And we are also again concerned with privacy preservation. So especially if we have huge data sets, it might make sense, for example, to mix those at points where they intersect, assuming they're close enough in order to get some kind of obfuscation while still being able to do important applications as traffic flow analysis. And also something we would like to contribute more to is to develop more efficient and flexible spatial data structures. As I told you, there's this huge set of movement trajectories, for example, in OpenStreetMap, but also, yeah, there are other databases. I know there's this MoveBank database, but there are also many more, and only very few of them really feature good search engines, which allow you to answer a broad spectrum of queries efficiently, where you can filter the data according to your needs. And yeah, there are lots of open questions we are interested in. But for now, I think, I gave you some overview of what our plans are and what our research interests are. And with that, I want to thank you very much for your attention. And I'm, of course, very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sabine, for this exciting talk and these wonderful examples you gave. Are there questions in the audience? And Sabine told me that she would want to take the questions herself, so you can just directly ask.
So are there any questions?
Super interesting talk, and I think a lot of really relevant methods for us. I was definitely getting excited by what you were talking about. I was curious for the thing about path selection, or inferring the preferences from the paths. Is that method only developed for the graph examples, or is that also working in free space? And then maybe as a follow-up, like, Does that also work in the context of a changing landscape, or does it have to be a fixed landscape?
Yes, they're good questions. Yes, as I said in the beginning, if you don't have a graph, we try to make one up. This, of course, might come with problems because you have these underlying assumptions, how you construct the graph, and this might actually keep you later on from analyzing the trajectories in a sound manner because you put in some assumptions already. So, for example, if you assume that people traverse shortest paths in between measurements, then of course later it's very hard to say, well, but the reason they chose that route was for something completely different. So there are other approaches one can use here. So for example, you can do map matching based solely on the shape of the trajectory, and then maybe you do not get this kind of distortion. And this is also something which works in free spaces. So you can also, for example, compute the path which just avoids obstacles without having any kind of further assumptions. But we have not tried to do that on completely unrestricted trajectory data. So we would need first a model which tells us how preferences are even assumed to happen there. But I think so this general framework of coming up with these constraints and then doing one by one, excluding certain options, this would work in a more general fashion, but it would depend on a precise model what we can actually reuse here.
Thanks.
Oliver has a question.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. I'm always fascinated by these topics. And can you go back to this question? What about machine learning? I mean, you said like it's very hard to get these parameters that somehow describe the user preferences. And if I think of myself, the problem is even more, I have different preferences. Like maybe for many of my paths, I want to go fast, but there are others where I have other. So like, is that the primary problem, like this kind of classification of preferences, or is also a problem this kind of unrestricted path length that makes it very hard for training networks? And could you deal with that by dividing paths and somehow restricting them?
Yes, so this is something we do anyway. So I did not mention that, but typically what we do is also segmentation of the trajectories because there might be parts, like, for example, if you, bring your kids to school, then it might be different preference than when you just go ahead now. And also, we also do some grouping, like there's some greedy algorithm which subdivides the trajectories into classes with different alpha preference vectors. Mm-hmm. So that is something we do anyway. Yeah, I think for the machine learning thing, I mean, we always need to state that we can have theoretical performance guarantees, right? So this is not something you would easily get. So we can make sure that if there is an alpha which explains that, or if there's a small group of alpha values which explain all of the trajectory choices, we will compute them for sure. Well, with machine learning, it might be that you learn on a lot of data, but then maybe some weirdo has some preference vector which the machine learning approach has never seen, and then it will never come up with that. Mm-hmm. So if you have like preferences which deviate much from the average person, and this is exactly what we would like to find, right? Then I think with machine learning, you would have a hard time to really come up with something out of the ordinary.
Yeah, so like this long tail problem that you don't have enough data.
Yes. And I think these are the really interesting, or these are the special cases that really need like personal route recommendations because they don't like what's usually given to them. And so I think it would be really difficult to get enough data on that or to interfere that with a machine learning approach.
All right. Yes, I would have a question that goes also in that direction. Thank you for the talk. These individual preferences, when you did the analysis, and I suppose you did the analysis with many, many people, How do they cluster? I mean, do people cluster? You find people of this sort, people of that sort, people of that sort? Or is the variability so high that it's more like times of the day that cluster, or different situations that cluster? So what kind of results do you get from people? And once you have that, what kind of experiments do you need to know that you are right? Right, because in the end you get a numerical output. Can you put questionnaires to people, or how do you test your results?
So we are kind of a toolmakers.carpenters. So actually what we did was we developed those tools and then, for example, Apple Maps used them, so we never get really access to this data. So we did our own tests by using random alpha values, then generating paths with those and trying whether we can recover these particular preferences. But for example, Apple Maps really use these in their production. And so what they see, so they don't use questionnaires, but they see whether people follow their route recommendations. So this is how they evaluate how good their recommendations work. And at least they claim that with these improved techniques, they see more people really following their recommendations. But these interesting questions that you ask, like how do people cluster and so on, I cannot answer because I don't really have access to this real data. So that would be really interesting to see. Also, I mean, there's always the problem with route recommendations. If you have traffic flow and you take that into consideration and you don't want to give everyone the same path, right? You have to decide like for people who then have to take a long route in order to not clutter certain types of streets. But they also use this to distribute people further, because if there are people preferring different routes, this problem becomes easier somewhat, and this seems to work well. But I cannot give you any kind of more detailed analysis of that because we did not do it on our own.
Cool. I had a question.
Sure.
I was curious whether your trajectory matching algorithm that allowed you to sort of take this human trajectory that isn't embedded in space and sort of match it to particular routes within the habitat, whether that would also work for matching to sort of, if you think about animals moving as a group, sort of doing trajectory matching and similarity indices for individuals moving together and thinking about sort of like patterns of leadership and followership.
Yes, so there are, of course, many different similarity measures for polylines in general, and also some of them taking time into account, like this Fichet distance or dynamic time warping. So there are plenty of those. So it might depend on the actual application. So some of those are bottleneck measures, which might not be ideal when we talk about groups. So shape matching could be something which I think could make sense, but there are so many different measures. It might depend on what you really want to learn in the end. I mean, I've shown these group diagrams, which are focused on like identifying the split and merge points of group movements. So if you want to have something like this, this also uses shapes and similarity measures between trajectories to come up with those. So this exists and works pretty well, I guess. But if you want to, for example, identify whether groups move similar, maybe in different territory or something like that, I think shape measurements would actually be something which could be used, yes. Stefan Roth, could you please tell me what are the mathematical challenges in a follow-up discussion? Okay, so we don't bore people with mathematical details now. Yes, there are plenty of nice theoretical challenges still hidden in there. And of course, I always talked only about very simplified models here. You can always make these things more and more realistic by incorporating more constraints, and then things get way more complicated and also more time consuming. I, of course, only told you about the success stories where everything is fast in the end, but we have many things in the basement that doesn't work as well. So yeah, I would be happy, of course, if there's more mathematical knowledge which we can use. Sana wrote, I don't have a camera working. I have a question. Could you use the match chair trajectories to backtrack and recalculate an open space as a defined landscape? What does a defined landscape in that scenario mean? I'm not familiar with that term. Could you? I create a route. Yes, I think that should be possible. Again, it depends on the precise application, right? What you want to achieve, or how coarse or fine-grained your route has to be. There are also methods which just consider homotopy. So for example, if something went left or right of a certain object or of a mountain, for example, or if they cross a river or not. So there are these broader categories. So this is something which works pretty well with the current approaches. But if you need something very fine-grained, then this might be a problem, because if you have, at least if you have a certain amount of uncertainty in your data, then it's always difficult to differentiate between, was this really like a small curve, or was this just a fluctuation in the measurements? So there are some problems there, but if you're happy with like a coarse-grained abstraction, then I think this would be one method which could be applied.
If there are no further questions, I just would like to say thank you, Sabine, on behalf of the whole cluster for this wonderful and super interesting talk. I think it was very enlightening. And we're very happy to have you here. And for everybody who still has a question, as Sabine said, she'll be happy to follow up with you on that. So thank you to everybody for the good discussion.
Thank you.